Okay, let's get started. Those are the statistics on the exam. Happy Halloween. I'm dressed up as the exam man. Those are the exams. I'm not going to return them until the end of the class because I used to be stupid. I would return the exams at the beginning of the class. People will mope through the entire class and they won't listen to me. So I decided that I'll give it at the end of the class so you get to mope in the next class. Not here. So you have fun here, and then whoever comes next class, you know, they can deal with you. Let's see. So, I'm going to put up the solutions. And then these I'm going to take back. Are there any general questions? Yes, sir. Oh, I forgot to. I'll send it to you. Yeah, I did have it somewhere, but I forgot to put it up. Other questions? Yes.
Have you decided on the weight factor instead of moving between?
No, I did not. No. Other questions? Okay. So I did say that the people who got more than 70, if they can guess who they are, I could give them a book. Some people guessed. And one of them is actually right, so I changed their marks so that I don't have to give the book. this was a trick question. but at least one person gets it correct, but they won't know, I guess. That's all we have to talk about exam. Is there anything that you need to, that there's some question that you just have to know the answer right now and cannot wait until I put up the answers? If you feel like talking about it, that's fine. Anybody has any questions? Okay. The rest of the semester, we're going to be doing first order logic in this week, which is essentially putting objects and relations and quantification into our logic. Okay. And what's interesting is we did propositional logic and we're doing first order logic. After propositional logic, we did probabilistic propositional logic. But there is no first order probabilistic logic that I can teach you. It's actually, as I mentioned earlier, there is work going on right now, but there's nothing that I can teach in a 471 course. It sort of tells you where we are in terms of the state of the art. Okay. There would be a project on the first order logic part. Basically, you would modify, essentially write your own prologue theorem prover. Okay. Once you learn first order logic, you learn exactly why prologue works. And so this would be a little list project where you would write your own, you make some changes and get a prologue interpreter going. Okay. So that's going to be the next project. The project, how is the project that is due on Thursday going? Going well? Okay. So my topics afterward are approximately to the end of the semester. I would be probably doing, after first order logic, I'll come back into probabilistic and first order logic and talk about how to handle time in logic. And so we get to talk a little bit about situation calculus and also about dynamic Bayes networks, which is, you know, generalizing and handling time in knowledge representation. And then I will start talking about learning, and then depending on how we go, we'll probably do more or less of machine learning in the rest of the semester. I believe Yeah. So I might also actually do CSP and satisfiability instead of doing so many lectures on learning. Right now, there's just way too many lectures on learning. 3 weeks is too much. So I might wind up doing some CSP and SAT somewhere in the middle. So that's where the semester is going. One specific issue is I will not be in town on 11/28, so I would need to make up for that class, and so I'm going to bug you to find a time where a majority of you are likely to be available so that I can make up for that class. And then on 11/28 itself, you get to do whatever else you want to do. And then the people who don't show up can still listen to the lecture on the recording and also see the with the slides. Okay. So this is just to let you know that I'm probably going to ask you for some time. Okay. Okay. So what we're going to do, as I said, is we looked at propositional logic, and then we looked at probabilistic propositional logic. So we're going to do this, which is first order predicate logic. And then depending on the time, I might do some of temporal logics and dynamic based networks, which is handling time in knowledge representation. That's later after this topic. The main change in first order logic, if you look at this was a slide we looked at long back, right? The main change in first order logic essentially is in propositional logic, you assume that the world is made up of statements, made up of statements that are either true or false. Okay, that's all you have. The only structure you assume the world has is that it has statement assertions that are either true or false. In first order logic, we assume that actually the world has more structure to it. It is made up of objects, there are relations between the objects, and the statements are really about whether certain objects have certain relations. So ultimately, you do talk about statements that are true or false in first order logic too, except the statements have structure in them. So the simplest thing could be, you know, we'll see this again in a minute, you might have love Tom, Jerry, okay, that is a proposition. You can think of it as a proposition, or you can think of it as, so this is essentially saying the love relation holds between the object Tom and object Jerry. In propositional logic, you would have written it something more like love Tom Jerry, or LTJ. So there is no more structure to that statement previously. Right now, each of the statements that you have are made up of smaller pieces, you know, relations and objects. Okay, so that gives a lot of extra representational power for first order logic, as we'll see. And later on, we will talk about, for example, having even more structure to the world and realizing, for example, time is a special type of entity. Okay, that's what is temporal logic all about. Okay. And like I said, this stuff is open, more or less. We don't really have very good 471 level material for first order probabilistic logic. Okay, again, I assume that several of you have probably heard of first order logic, so I'll go reasonably quickly, but stop me if you have questions, okay? So you understood propositional logic, so we'll keep repeatedly making connections to propositional logic, you know, when we're talking about first order logic. So, as I said, first order logic has objects and relations. So the relations really are in terms of predicates. Okay, predicate symbol is a relation. So loves would be a predicate. Okay? You have constants which correspond to one, you know, constants are one type of object. Okay? There are constants, there are predicates, there are functions, variables, and then these things that you know, which is connectives, which connect various sentences. Okay? So this part you already know, disjunction, conjunction, negation, implication, double implication, and then equality and quantifier. Those you know, okay? These actually, you are essentially, as I said from this, you would use predicates and constants to, in some sense, make up something like proposition, to give yourself like a place to hold on, to think of first order logic as making up propositional symbols by putting objects and propositions and predicates together. So loves Tom Jerry would be essentially a statement. Okay? And then I can make statements of the following form. Loves Tom Jerry implies won't kill Tom Jerry. That's a statement. Okay? And now that could be in the propositional logic, you may have written this as LTJ implies WTJ. But here you actually have it written in terms of objects. Now, if you have objects and relations, these are these other things which are using them. So functions are applied to objects to give you new objects. Functions are applied to objects to give you new objects. So for example, a function could be square root, a function could be left leg up, a function could be father of. Okay? So father of an object will give me another object. So in fact, I may not have to have a separate name for this object. I can just, for example, say father of Tom. Okay? That would be an object now. So I get to write it anywhere the object occurs. So love, Tom, father of Tom. Okay? And then the interesting thing about functions, of course, is you can apply them repeatedly. So if father of Tom is an object, then so is father of Tom. And so is father of, all that stuff. Okay? So one of the interesting things, and you'll keep seeing this being harped on many, many times, is the moment you have a function symbol thrown in, you in essence have infinite number of object referents. Okay? And each of them could be actually different objects in the real world. In fact, father of is like that, right? I mean, if you have father of Tom is a different object from father of Tom, which is a different object from father of Tom. Okay? And similarly, you can also have, for example, successor, you know? So any of these functions, the moment you have a function symbol, then normally you get to write large number of additional object referents, which could correspond to real, different, distinct real-world objects. They could also correspond to the same object. We don't know. Okay, but the interesting thing is, it allows you, so if you have, let's say, five constants, then there are really five objects in the world. If you throw in one function symbol, you have how many objects in the world now? Infinite. Okay, throwing in a function symbol changes the world completely. Okay. So in first order logic, the number of constants is always finite. You assume that the number of constants in the language is finite. The infinity comes because of functions. Functions can take constants and create new constants. Okay, the infinite objects come not because there are infinite number of constants to begin with, but because there are finite number of constants applied. If you have even a single function symbol, you can make more constants on demand. Okay. So then the only other thing that I did not talk about, so I talked about constants, functions, connectives, equality, predicates, quantifiers, and variables. These are connected. Okay. A variable essentially is a variable referring to some unknown object. It's just like your normal understanding of a variable. Okay. So for example, I can write loves X, Jerry. That's syntactically valid because a variable can be an object referent. And Jerry, of course, is an object. Now, the only thing, of course, is if you just have a variable, what is the scope of this variable? What is it ranging over? There are two ways you restrict the scope of the variables in first order logic. For all, there exists. Okay? So the normal way you can restrict in this particular case, this is a syntactically valid sentence, but it's not a well-formed formula. That means you cannot talk about the truth and falsity of this particular statement. Okay? Yes?
I have one question. When you're talking about functions,
No, not at all. No, but I mean the functions define implicitly new constants. See, you don't need to know that my father has a name. You know that father of Rav is a real object. And so is father of Rav. Okay, names are just things that we make for an extra shortcut to the entity. But all you need to care about is there is a distinct entity called father of Rav. Because father of is a function. These are the base set, exactly. So it's like the fact that there are only finite number of constants doesn't make any difference. The moment you throw in a function, there are really infinite number of effective constants. Okay. However, this is basically telling you that this is why when you hear, you'll hear again throughout the discussion as we go forward that one way to restrict the scope of first order logic is to say we don't like functions. We don't want functions. And if you say we don't want functions, it turns out everything else but no functions. It turns out that part of first order logic is cheaper, much easier than full first order logic. Why? Even from our discussion, if you have no functions, then there really are only a finite number of constants. Okay? And you can make up, so if you have Tom and Jerry are the only constants in your knowledge base, and loves is the only relation, you can write loves Tom Jerry, loves Jerry Jerry, loves Jerry Tom. Done. They really are four proposition symbols. So you can compile down first order logic into propositional logic. It's a good thing to do. I mean, all higher level languages are compiled down into assembly language, right? So when can you compile down first order logic to propositional logic, which we know, love, and understand? And it turns out function-free first order logic can be compiled down to propositional logic. Okay? So the rest is just syntactic sugaring, which isn't bad, because what is C and Java compared to assembly? Syntactic sugaring. No? I mean, makes a big difference. Right? You know, you don't have to write assembly language. You know, a C program can always be compiled down into a finite sized assembly program. Okay? And so first order logic without functions is compilable to propositional logic. So in its expressive power, it's equivalent. Because anything that can be said in first order logic can also be said, anything that can be said in first order logic without function symbols can also be said in propositional logic. This should be known by now, because the moment you understand functions are the way infinite number of constants come in. You understood this. Yes, sir.
It's not necessarily a function will definitely introduce infinite, because that also depends on your constant. Right? Like, for example, if you had a function called sitting next to, and your constant for people sitting in a circle, the number of constants will still be finite. It's not like you are infinite.
Okay, so I'll give you an even better example for your question, to make your point. Parity of is a function. Okay? It can take any number and take even and odd as the answer. Okay? Right? This is what you understand. So that also makes your point that, you know, a parity of does not create infinite number of constants, it only creates two new constants. This is a question you should have. Okay? And if you don't come to terms with this question, you don't understand logic. Okay? The idea is there is nothing in a name. Okay? I put loves Tom Jerry and you people are smiling. What do you know what loves is? Loves is just, I could have basically said, in essence, R99 O71 O35, and you won't smile as much, right? I argue that if you had this and then this sentence, you know, you could have had basically there is nothing here that's not here. If there is a semantics for any symbol, a relation, it would come because of the way it is connected to other relations. Kids know this. When you were born, you knew this too. You can call anything by any name, We'll say, we'll pretend that this rose is a soap, and then we'll start talking about it as if it's a soap. But it doesn't become a soap, it's still a rose. And the rose is a rose not because it's called rose, but because of its properties, because how it is connected to other things in the world. Now the question is, when I write parity, let's say F001, so for example, instead of saying father of, if I said R99 F07 of O71 F09 of O35. Suppose I said that. You have no clue what these functions are. In general, we'll be seeing, for example, in a minute about task chain interpretations, where we will try to give semantics to the logic by associating each object to each constant to a real world object, each function to a real world function. I could have associated this function F07 to parity of, in which case it would have only generated two new constants. I could have associated this function F07 to father of. I could have associated with it to the next in the line of, whatever. And the semantics shouldn't depend upon what I associate it with in the world. And this is the same in propositional logic too. For example, H implies S. Okay? You know S is true, according to first propositional logic. What is H? You don't care. What is S? You don't care. I can give infinite number of interpretations for H and S. Irrespective of the interpretations I give, if H is true in the world, if H implies S is true in your world, then S is true. That's it. H could be Rav is happy, S could be Rav is smiling. And in which case you can say, since Rav currently is happy, Rav would be smiling. Or H could be something completely different. Now Bush is alive, and Bush is alive means something, you know, add whatever you want, and then that thing will be true. Okay? So you really have to understand that the interpretation that you give to a proposition symbol better not change the semantics of the language. It must be over all possible interpretations of H and S. This is true. So that's a very good question. I normally send a mail, but I don't have to send that mail. Indeed, it is the case that a function symbol could very well correspond to only two possible outputs, 0 and 1. But you don't know. You could have, you know, when you write a knowledge base, you better not take anything extra as to what these things will be connected to in the real world. Okay? So the only thing that I was saying is variables and quantifiers. If you have variables, then you can restrict the scope of the variable by putting a quantification. So if I say loves X Tom, really I'll write these things, English sentences, so that you know you feel as if there is some meaning to them, but this has no connection to what loves means and what X means and what Tom means. Okay? So I could say for all X loves X Tom, all that essentially means is that for every possible value of X, loves X Tom is true. So what does this mean? In a database where there are two symbols, Jerry and Tom, what does this correspond to? This corresponds to loves Tom Tom and loves Jerry Tom. That's it. Loves Tom Tom and loves Jerry Tom. For all is a shortcut for conjunction. Anytime you see for all, remember conjunction. For all is a shortcut for conjunction. Now how big a shortcut can it be? Depends on how many objects you have. If you threw in a function, father of, then that one single for all x Love's X term corresponds to an infinitely large conjunction. So Love's term, term, Love's father of term, term, Love's father of 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 term, term. Okay? And then the whole thing again for the second one. Okay? So for all basically gives you a big conjunction. The other is that there exists. And all there exists does is it's a disjunction. Okay, so there exists X, Love's X term is that Love's term term or Love's Jerry term. Yes, sir. No, so you decide upfront what symbols are functions, what symbols are predicates. Okay? And during modeling, you could have decided that some property of the world is best modeled as a function or it is best modeled as a relation. Okay? It's completely up to you. In fact, there is this whole thing called, I might say it again later on, reification, which essentially takes a first order knowledge base where there are predicates and makes those predicates into sort of functions. Okay? So for example, instead of saying, I mean it turns out this is useful since you asked me, okay, this is useful to say things like this. So suppose I wanted to say that B is on top of A at time t. At time t. One way of saying this is on A, B, T. If I write it this way, on is a predicate. A and B are constant. T also is a constant. Okay? I could also have written it in a different way, in a different, not in this knowledge base, in a different knowledge base. I could have, let's say this is capital O, I could have written it as folds small on A, B, T. Okay? So this, you could have modeled this using this sort of language or this sort of language. You can take a single program and write it, I mean a single problem and write 15 different C language programs for it. All of which give the right answer for the problem. Okay? It's just that once you decide what the variables stand for, what the data structures stand for, you better be consistent throughout the throughout your program. Otherwise, your program won't go anywhere. You can do it in one way, your friend can do it another way. So in this particular case, I have decided to go with on as a function name. So in this database, I better not use on anywhere where a relation is expected. It's the same way in C, right? I mean, you could decide something is a procedure name or a variable name. But once you decide, you better stick to it. Otherwise, the compiler is going to yell at you, saying, hey, you just, you know, declared it as a procedure. How come you are using it as a variable? Okay? So first order logic is a programming language for writing knowledge. That's one way of thinking about it. Okay, so this idea is called reification, and it's actually, we might talk about it when we talk about situation calculus. Okay, so in some sense, you took a relation on which holds between two objects A, B and made it look as if it is a function. So on A, B is either 1 or 0. Now, that's exactly what you're looking for. Okay? Any other question? Okay, so we have basically looked at the entire syntax, but in looking at the syntax, we also looked at the semantics. Yes, sir.
How you differentiate, for example, on A, B with a, if you want to test if A is on B, how do you differentiate those two functions? I don't know how you call the second one. For example, make a function called is on A, B.
So, no. let me see if I can answer this, what you're asking. So, you want to, no, the only things that only things that first order logic gives you are function symbols, predicate symbols, constants. So the question is, what you want your is on to be? You want it to be a predicate? Is it a relation that will hold to be true or false? in which case what you have is fine. I mean, you actually can write, I can ask, for example, here, give me all x's such that on x b holds. In fact, this is what we do in Prolog.
So this is both as creating the relation and also returning values from the same.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I think what is happening here is it's not that it's, you know, the programming language metaphor does break down in some places. It's not that this thing is returning anything. This is actually on a b is an object now. Because if on is a function applied to objects returns an object. So wherever you could use objects, you could use this. And now in this new world, in this world, holds is the only predicate symbol. In this world, on is a predicate symbol. I could have written my world this way or this way, but I can't combine them. Makes no sense. Okay? Keep those kinds of questions in mind because we'll talk about more about how to write predicate logic databases. Okay, so then now let's look at some things that we looked at already, but quickly go through again. How do you make sentences in first order logic? You make sentences by basically starting with the small pieces and putting them together to make the larger ones. So atomic sentence you need to understand first. An atomic sentence essentially is of the form love, Tom, Jerry. Okay. So in particular, actually, you write an atomic sentence as a predicate of terms. Where a predicate, you know what a predicate is. Terms are recursively defined. Every constant is a term. Every variable is a term. Every function symbol applied to terms is a term. Which makes sense because you apply functions to objects, you get new objects. So terms essentially are generalized reference to objects. So wherever you expect an object, you can write a term there. And so an atomic sentence, syntactically correct atomic sentence has predicate of terms. Okay? And so if the predicate has been used once as an NRE predicate, then every time it has to be used as an NRE predicate. You have to be consistent. Okay? So for example, here, and so notice that variable is fine. You could have, a term could be just a variable. Because a term could be a variable, a function of constants and variables would be a term too. Okay? So in particular, according to this definition, love's father of X, mother of Y. It's fine. It's an atomic sentence. Unfortunately, it's not a well-formed sentence because the variable scope has not been restricted. You don't know what X is ranging over, what Y is ranging over. Okay? But it's still an atomic sentence. Okay? So here is the one where, for example, brother, King John, Richard the Lionheart, that's an obviously simple one. And similarly, greater than length of the left lug of Richard is, this object is greater than this object. Okay, so apparently King Richard has a bigger left leg than King John. That's what we are saying here. Okay. Complex sentences. Once I know first, how to write atomic sentences, I can throw in all my connectives and make new sentences. Okay? In particular, all these things that you knew from proposition logic can still be used. In general, any place where you could have put a proposition symbol in the proposition logic, you now can put an atomic sentence there. You can think of atomic sentences as propositions with internal structure. Okay? So here, not S, S1 and S2, S1 or S2, S1 implies S2, all this stuff. And then now notice these are recursive, so you can write really complex sentences by doing this. And the one other thing, of course, is another way of writing, complex sentences is quantification. So if in fact some of the atomic sentences that you are using have variables which have not been quantified by any quantifier, whose scope is not restricted by any quantifier, then you have to throw in quantifiers which takes in the scope. And we already noticed that there are two quantifiers, one is for all and one is for each. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah. No. A variable essentially is a referent to a term. In fact, what you just asked also brings up a very interesting question. What are we quantifying over? What are we quantifying over? We are quantifying over variables which refer to terms. You don't get to quantify over predicates. Suppose I want to say the following thing. All predicates in my world are symmetric. All predicates in my world are symmetric. It looks like it should be possible to say for all predicates, P symmetry holds. You can't say that in first order logic. If you have 10,000 predicates, you have to write 10,000 different sentences saying predicate 1 is symmetric, predicate 2 is symmetric, predicate 10,000 is symmetric. This is where the first order comes in the first order logic. Okay? You are not quantifying over predicates. If you start quantifying over predicates, you get second order. Okay? So it's an important question to keep in mind. I mean, while, so you know that C is higher than you know, assembly language, but Python is higher than C. So this higher levelness can be, you know, invented more and more. Okay, so much so that if you know exact, you know, you could have a language which allows you to just say any program in like one statement. Okay, so first order logic in the hierarchy of languages, you know, obviously first order logic is more expressive and so more concise than propositional logic. But second order logic would be even more concise than first order logic. But the problem is we have our hands full dealing with first order logic, as we'll see in a minute. Okay, computationally, reasoning with first order logic is already at the limit of things that computers can do. In particular, we'll see that if a theorem is true, you will find it. You will be able to prove that the theorem is true in finite amount of time. All bets are off as to how finite the finite is. So before the universe ends and you die, you may be able to prove it. I mean, you will guarantee to prove it in finite time. If the theorem is false, I'm sorry, if the theorem is false, all bets are off. You will never be able to actually show that the theorem is false. So in fact, you say that first order logic inference is semi-decidable. So it's decidable if the theorem is true, and it's not decidable if the theorem is false. And when you have a theorem, do you know whether it's true or false? If you know, why the heck do you want to ask the program? Right? So it's basically a useless thing. In a sense, if you know, in general, you don't know whether the theorem is true or false, and so you essentially will never be able to, you know, so computationally, first order, you know, inference is very hard. I mean, semi-decidability makes NP completeness look like piece of cake. NP completeness is just exponential. Semi-decidable means sometimes program would not terminate. It just won't terminate. And it's not terminate in 2 days, it just won't terminate, that's all. Okay? So that's part of the reason why we won't go up to second order logic. And in fact, that's also part of the reason why, despite the fact that we love first order logic, every opportunity we get, we will try to compile it down to propositional logic. Because that's something that we can deal with. It is exponential. Of course, it could be exponential in a bigger number, but that's still better than semi-decidable. Okay. It turns out, obviously, that knowing the conservation of complexity, you cannot take first-order logic which is semi-decidable and then convert it down to propositional logic, because then there is something wrong. Okay. So it turns out that the only part of the first-order logic that you can convert to propositional logic is the one which doesn't have function symbols. So for first order logic without function symbols, inference complexity is not semi-decidable. It's only NP complete. Okay. Okay. So this is complex sentences, and then we are talking about universal quantification. We looked at it earlier. A universal quantification really is a large conjunction. In general, you can, earlier I only looked at universal quantification over an atomic sentence, but you can have universal quantification over any complex sentence which has unbound variables. Right? So for example here, at X, Berkeley implies smart X. And obviously this is wrong, but you know, Stuart Russell wrote this. So at X, Berkeley implies smart X is a complex sentence which has unbound variables. So you then make it into a well-formed sentence by throwing in a quantifier. Now notice that I could have put a for all X here and it will be fine, or I could have put a there exists X and it would have been fine too. What do you mean by fine? All it means is it would be a sentence whose truth or falsity can be uniquely determined given an interpretation. Ultimately, that's the only thing that we are saying. Now, what you wanted to write may be this or may be there exists. That only you would know what you wanted to write. Okay, as in the exam, I noticed, I repeated the point that as you throw in extra facts into your knowledge base, you are reducing the number of words that you could potentially be in. You better make sure that you are throwing away the words that you don't really want to be in, and not throwing away the words that you actually think you are in. Okay, so that is the question of semantics. You know, a C compiler can tell you whether your program is syntactically correct. It cannot tell you whether your program is semantically correct. That you do, you know, by spending a lot of time and trying to see, hey, how come this makes no sense? Okay, so for all XP is equivalent to a conjunction of instantiations of P. In this particular case, if you have King John and Richard and Berkeley are the only constants, then this single sentence here corresponds to this particular thing. At King John, Berkeley implies smart King John. At Richard, Berkeley implies smart Richard. And at Berkeley, Berkeley implies smart Berkeley. It's very important to write this because we try to add meaning to these things, but it's just a language. You know, it basically thinks of these as, this is a place where predicate symbols come, these are terms, and this is an implication. It's a connective, and here is another atomic sentence. That's it. Okay. Don't look at the lower part. We'll talk about it in a minute. Similarly, I could also have written, so suppose I have this complex sentence, at X, Stanford implies, and smart X, and I could, there again, X is unbound, and so I write, there exists X, at X, Stanford, smart X. That would be a valid sentence. So would be for all X, at X, Stanford, and smart X. Now the question, of course, is what could you possibly be interested in saying? You could have wanted to say either of them, but more often than not, you would probably not write. Okay, let me actually show you that. Let's not use this example. Let's use another example. Okay, let's do this. More parochial. Okay. So let's write this. How would we want to write this? Everyone at ASU is smart. Okay. Let me see if I can get. Okay. I have two ways of writing this. This is what I want to say. Everyone at ASU is smart. I could write this as, for all X, at X, ASU implies smart X. Or I can write this as, for all X, at X, ASU and smart X. Which one would be the right way of saying this? First one. What's wrong with the second one? There's nothing wrong with the second one. That's probably not what you wanted to say. So what is the second one saying? Everyone is at ASU and everyone is smart. Every X is at ASU and every X is also smart. Both are true. You could have wanted to say that. You know, I could have basically wanted to say, I mean, I was like a very nice person and I wanted to say everybody is at ASU and everybody is smart. And if I did want to say that, this is what I should write. More often than not, I would have liked to say something like everyone at ASU is smart. If they are not an ASU, they are not smart. I mean, I didn't want to say that. I mean, if they are an ASU, they are definitely smart. They may be noisy or ways of being smart otherwise too, but definitely if they are an ASU, they are smart. Okay? And so, oftentimes, if you are using for all, it goes with implication. Now, this is a rule. This is not a syntactic rule. You could write either of those, and they are completely well-formed formulas in logic. It's just that if you ever find writing this, ask yourself, really, did I want to say that? If you wanted to say that, fine. Okay? More often than not, you would find that really you probably wanted to say the other one. Okay? The same thing, someone at UI is smart. I could write this way, there exists X, at X UA implies smart X. Or there exists X, at X UA and smart X. What would be the right way to say this sentence? What? So what's wrong with the first one? So remember, how did I convince myself that this is not what I wanted to say? I want to ask myself, is this sentence going to be referring to the kind of words I wanted to refer to? And is this sentence going to be removing the kind of words that I wanted to remove? Now, if I threw in this sentence, it would not be true in any world where some people are not at ASU. Do you understand what I'm saying? Just because there is somebody else who is not at ASU, this entire sentence is out the window. Right? In any world where there is at least one person, one object that's not at ASU, it's not even a person, you know. Chakpi is not in ASU, so the entire sentence is false because it's a conjunctive sentence. So now in that sentence, I'm still at ASU and I want to be smart. I'm being thrown along with this, like, you know, we are throwing the baby with the bathwater, raw with the chakpi. So you want to stop that. And so I say, this is not what I meant, and I remove it. So this is what you think when you want to see, is this the right sentence that I wanted to say? You're thinking in terms of what words am I leaving in, what words am I leaving out? Okay? So now, you guys said, this is what is the right way to say this, and this is not. Tell me why that's wrong. Why is this wrong?
The first one you're saying, if said it's someone at your page, then that person is smart, which is not what we want to say. We want to say that there are...
So tell me a world where this sentence would be true, but the English sentence should not be true. Think about it that way. Because in a way, I removed this because in a world where Rav is at ASU and Rav is smart, this sentence, Rav is the only guy at ASU and Rav is smart. I'm being more parochial than expected. And this sentence is true because I'm the only guy and I'm smart. But then, you know, somebody else is not at ASU, because of them, this sentence is being made false. Did you understand what I'm saying? So, tell me a world where this sentence is true and this is not, or vice versa. Think of a world where there is a nuclear holocaust in Tucson and everybody left University of Arizona. There's nobody left. Okay, I don't ask, yes sir. No, what this first sentence says, I'm just using English here, okay, I'm saying is, and this is very nice because only in America you can interpret this English sentence from Turkish background, and I can say you're wrong from Telugu background, and the guys who are born here can keep quiet. Someone at UA is smart, mostly what I think most English-speaking people, including us, mean is there exists at least one person in U of A who is smart. The entire place may be going to dogs, but at least there is one person. And if you really make me produce somebody, I will produce somebody from U of A who is smart. Now, consider a world, there is a nuclear holocaust and everybody left U of A. There is nobody at U of A. Is this sentence true?
Yes.
since nobody is at U of A, this part is false, so this sentence is true. In an implication, antecedent is false, the whole thing is true. So basically, so the reason, it's not just a question of more correct. I mean, it's, this would be true when U of A is, has nobody. But this sentence would not be true when U of A is nobody, has nobody, because you are saying someone at U of A is actually smart. Yes, sir. Yeah, I mean, no, I think, in fact, these, between these two, this is what you wanted to say. There exists at least one X such that at X, UA, and smart X. So in particular, suppose your world only contains two constants and no function symbols, Tom and Mary. Okay? This sentence says at Tom U of A and smart Tom, or at Mary U of A and smart Mary. It better be correct, because if in a world where there are only two people in the entire world, someone at U of A is smart means either Tom or Mary is smart. Otherwise, you're in big trouble. Okay? And that will be fine. Whereas this one would not work out. Why won't it work out? Because this sentence will become at Tom U of A implies smart Tom, and R at Mary U of A implies smart Mary. In a world not at Tom U of A is true and not at Mary U of A is true, this sentence is true, but the other sentence is not, and you don't want the sentence to be true. Okay? How do you know that the program you wrote on the computer for your C program, you have been given an English description of a problem. You wrote up some random sequence of C instructions. Compiler says you're fine. Okay, that means there are right number of semicolons and right number of, you know, syntaxes, all the syntaxes are satisfied. How do you check whether it's actually what you wanted to write? This is the kind of reasoning you do. You know, is the program representing the kinds of worlds that I am interested in and removing the worlds that I'm not interested in? That's exactly what you're doing here. Yes? Yes. What does it mean to convert first order logic to propositional logic? Ultimately, semantics, in fact, the very next thing we'll do, ultimately semantics for first order logic can be driven from propositional logic truth tables too. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. A few more things about writing sentences in first order logic. One, as I said, again, this is kind of repetition. You get to decide, and I give you some knowledge, that you have some knowledge that you want to write in first order logic. You get to decide what your predicates, functions, constants, etc. are. If you're given a problem specification in a programming competition, do they tell you that your variable's name should be UX and WY? No. Do they tell you what your function should be? No. What your procedure name should be? No. You get to make any of them, as long as you're consistent. Okay? So you get to decide what the names are. And when you write English sentence in a FOPC sentence, you can double check by asking yourself if there are worlds where FOPC sentence doesn't hold and the English one holds, and vice versa, which is exactly what you did. This is how you check whether you wrote what you meant or not. Okay? Now, can this be automated? Nah, of course not. If this can be automated, then you guys don't have to write programs. You know, it's like basically I'm saying there'll be an English description and you write a program and an oracle says you have done it right. You know, right now there is no oracle telling you that. Okay? So you are checking this. One very interesting connection, and maybe we'll talk about it a little later, is given the same exact piece of English knowledge that everybody, that you know and your friend knows, you guys can come up with completely different predicates, completely different functions and completely different sentences based on that. Okay? You may both be right in the sense that all the words where the English specification is true, the sentences are true and vice versa. And yet your names, you called them completely different names. And it could even be the case that, as I told you earlier in that holds and on example, you may have used some things as function symbols and your friend may have used those same things as predicate symbols. So it's not like just because you converted a piece of English language, English or whatever, natural knowledge that you have into first order logic, that there is a unique representation. Of course not. Okay? Now, there is this whole thing that's going around called semantic web. And what is semantic web? You write your web page and you write a bunch of sentences in the background about relations between your web page and other people's web page, as well as relations between different pieces of your own web page. And then, of course, you then go to somebody's web page. Not only do you see the English representation, you also see the first order logic representation. And you have a theorem prover, which you're going to learn about in a minute or two. And then you can just get the theorem prover cranking, and we can get out of this business of text-based understanding of web. Great idea. The biggest bottleneck for semantic web is that there is no standardization on the predicate names and function names and so on. So the same exact thing, different people will wind up using different predicate symbols. It's a big problem. Okay? So in first order, in semantic web, there's this whole idea called ontology mapping. So what's the basic idea? So if I have P, Q as my predicates, and this guy here has M and W as their predicates, you would like to say, for example, that my P is the same as your W, and my Q is the same as your M. That's a mapping. How many mappings do you need this way? For every pair of pages, you need to give a mapping. You might as well just take the phone and talk to the guy. Forget about giving mappings, right? So another way that people try to deal with this is stare down at people and say, thou shalt use correct names. Okay, all of you should use P's and Q's. No more M's and W's for you. That goes against the philosophy of web. Okay, so, and even if you yell at them, nobody's going to pay any attention. You know, it's like, do you know how many pages have bad HTML on the web? Who cares? You know, who's going to sue me if I have bad HTML? So I'll write anything I want. So you can't standardize by fiat. You can't yell at people and say, thou shalt all use the same name. So you have to provide mappings. One idea of providing mappings is mapping between each pair of pages, which is the first dumb idea you should get. And a slightly less dumb idea would be to say that there are brokers who think in terms of G1s and G2s, let's say. You tell that my P is same as your G1, my Q is same as your G2. This guy says my W is same as your G1, my M is same as your G2. So indirectly, I have established a mapping. This can reduce the number of number. It's no longer pairwise. You know, everybody just needs to register themselves to a known ontology. This idea of mapping yourself to the other guy, that's sort of a registration process. Now, it's not very clear that anybody will do this either, except it's at least less than n square mapping. You understand? So there you hear semantic web in a lecture on first order logic, because semantic web really is first order logic. Okay? And unfortunately, semantic web is first order logic where everybody is writing first order logic. First order logic in 471 is first order logic where you write your first order logic, she writes her first order logic. So you guys just need to be consistent with respect to yourself. On the web, everybody is making up different predicate names, and how do we make sure that I could be calling same thing by different names? Okay. So again, this and this are well connected. This is beautiful freedom. Name, there is nothing in a name. And the fact that there's nothing in a name kills you when you are trying to standardize over billions of pages. Okay, as I said, caveat, another caveat of course is decide whether a symbol is a predicate, constant, or a function. Make sure you decide what these are and just stick to them. Yeah, as long as you are the only guy dealing with your knowledge base, if you are consistent, you're fine. Okay. Order of quantifiers matters. This is something that you may or may not realize. Okay. So for all x, there exists here x for all y loves x y. This one, for all y, there exists x loves x y. Looks like very similar sentences, but they mean completely different things. And you don't have to believe me because I said so. You can just do this from first principles. You realize that for all is a conjunction, there exists is a disjunction. And try this out on a small world with a couple of objects, and you know, expand them out and see to yourself, you know, convince yourself that there are actually different in meaning. So for example, in a world where the only two constants are Fido and Tweety, there exists x for all y loves x y will ultimately become, so I'll remove this first, there exists x, loves x Fido and loves x Tweety. I just removed one quantifier and made it into a conjunction. Now I remove the second quantifier. Now this becomes loves Fido Fido and loves Fido Tweety, or loves Tweety Fido and loves Tweety Tweety. This is what I mean by this sentence. What's important about it is everybody in this world must be loved by one particular object. The same object must be loving everybody. That's what this world is saying, because either Fido is loving Fido as well as Tweety, or Tweety is loving Fido as well as Tweety. And this one, on the other hand, for all y, there exists x, loves xy. And this essentially allows different people loving different people. It could also allow the same person loving everybody, but it's more flexible. Okay? So, in particular, what we're saying here is, either it is the case that Fido loves Fido, either Fido loves Fido and Tweety, or Tweety loves Fido. So Fido is loved by either Fido or Tweety, and similarly Tweety is loved by either Fido or Tweety. For everybody there exists somebody who could be different. So this would be true if, for example, Fido loves himself and Tweety loves herself, whereas this won't be true in that world. So this world, this won't work in a narcissistic world where people only love themselves and nobody else. Okay, whereas this sentence will hold in both narcissistic world as well as world, different people love different people. Okay. So order matters. And not only does order matter, but you can actually figure this out in a fundamental way by just thinking in terms of what the conjunctions represent. What? Okay, so if you have a predicate that is symmetric, then you are writing an extra sentence stating that the predicate is symmetric. Then, of course, it may not matter. I don't know. Okay? But in general, a predicate doesn't have to be symmetric unless you say so. This we already did. Okay. In the next few minutes, we'll talk about the beginnings of semantics for first-order logic. It's nice to know that they started 450 BC trying to think of logic and think of stating knowledge in terms of formal logic and think of how to inference with them automatically. And they ended in 1965 when Alan Robinson actually found a practical method, which is the first order version of resolution theorem proving. First order version of resolution theorem proving, which essentially allowed you to do the semi-decidable theorem proving. That means when the theorem is in fact provable, you know, Alan Robinson's method would allow you to do that, to do the proof. Okay? It's more practical than the other guy. The practical is, of course, in quotes. All that means is it's more practical than the people who came before. Okay? They were using fewer infinities. And what's interesting is there is a story that when electricity was first invented, it was such a fad that people will be wearing all sorts of funny thingamajigs with electricity flowing through them. Okay, so people will wear like, you know, hats. Even now they wear it in like July 4th or something. But, you know, hats with light blinking on them, or shirts with light blinking on them. They were like, they were thinking, you know, this is it. You know, everything can be, you know, that's like the big fad. And when finally first order logic could find a practical inference procedure, the assumption was that we are done. As far as AI is concerned, it's done. All we need is take all you know, write it into first order logic. Carl Robinson, you know, who sits in Syracuse, who used to sit in Syracuse, I don't remember where he sits anymore, and just tell him, you know, here's my knowledge and, you know, is this true? Okay? And in fact, for the longest time, that's what AI, the enterprise of AI in terms of research was trying to just write everything into first order logic and make sure that the inferences work. Now, you guys are much smarter. We came to it only in the middle of the semester, and you already know that theorem proving is not a magic bullet. There's a huge amount of search in theorem proving. You need to control the search. Furthermore, first order logic makes certain types of assumptions about the world, for example, determinism, which may or may not make sense for other words. Okay? But it was a big watershed event, you know, when Robinson got the resolution theorem proving worked out. Okay, let's look at what it is that you would do. The basic idea to give semantics for first order logic is we'll try to give semantics for first order logic the same way we try to give semantics for propositional logic. We'll think in terms of interpretation, model. Okay? Now the general idea, of course, is that an interpretation specifies referents for constant symbols and predicate symbols and function symbols in the real world. So in particular, you can say constant symbols are connected to real objects in your world. Predicate symbols are connected to real relations in your world. Function symbols are connected to real functions in your real world. And given this interpretation, then you can check whether a first order sentence holds. Because every first order sentence ultimately is really a ground sentence. For every first order sentence, especially without function, so let's see, no. May not say that. So you can take a first order sentence and see whether it actually holds, which basically means if one of my sentences in my database is let's say so suppose here is my L is my predicate symbol and I have LTM and not LMT. LTM, these are my sentences. Let me write this. LTM, and for all x, LX, and for all xy, LXY implies LYX. This is my first order logic database. You don't know what L is, what x and y are. I mean, of course, x and y are variables. T and M are constants, and L is a predicate symbol. I'll give it an interpretation. I will say, in the real world, L is love relation. Love in English, that you understand. Because none of us really understand it, but they act as that. Okay. T is Tom. You know, the cat. Tom is the cat or Jerry is the cat?
Tom
is the dog. Okay, see, I'm on the ground. Okay, Tom. And M is not even Jerry. Okay, but M is Jerry. Let's make Jerry. I can make it anything I want. M is Jerry. Okay? And in this world, I happen to know that does not love, who likes who? I don't know. I'll say does not love Jerry. So, no, actually a relation, the love relation. The love relation is the following set of apples. Tom, Jerry, Tom, Jerry. This is the relation in the real world. That's in the real world, Tom loves Tom, Jerry loves Jerry, Tom also loves Jerry. This is the real relation. Now, so in this interpretation, is this particular sentence, is this sentence true? LTM, is that true? TM, T is Tom, M is Jerry. Tom, Jerry is true in the relation. So this sentence, you're okay. What about this guy? Because Tom loves Jerry, it better be the case that Jerry loves Tom. That's not true. So, in this interpretation, this sentence is true, this sentence is false, so the conjunction is false. So, this interpretation doesn't correspond to a model for this database. This is how you go through the step. Okay? Now, the question, of course, is, so if I have, you know, if I have my objects are kings and different sizes, legs and so on, then again you have this kind of a thing. The objects are different actual people in the world and the relations, just like this relation. And then if there is a functional relation, you can also give the functional definition. A function takes an object and gives a new object out. And given this, you can check whether individual sentences hold in this interpretation or not. Okay? All that you need to do is that. Okay. Now, of course, how many interpretations are there? Gazillion, billion, gillion. Because, in essence, notice that I could have done LTM, L could be love, L could be hate, L could be stands on top of, L could be, you know, hits on the face of, or whatever. Okay. Any relation, any real world relation can be L. Any real world object can be T. Any real world object can be M. And any specific real world relation that you get to define can be the definition of L. Looks like there's too many interpretations. These interpretations are called Tarskian interpretations. Okay. If you are in the business of using Tarskian interpretations to do automated theorem proving, you would never go anywhere. Now, did you have this problem for propositional logic? Why did we not worry about this for propositional logic? We didn't worry about it because we just skipped over it. Okay. We essentially realized that when you have a propositional logic database where there's a P and P implies Q, the P should be a real world assertion. P and Q should be a real world assertion. And I could have made any number of real world assertions corresponding to P and Q, just as I said in the beginning of the class. Okay, but what we notice is, irrespective of those assertions, all these interpretations here are equivalent in terms of the truth-falsity values they give to the atomic sentences. In particular, or in the case of propositional logic, the many different interpretations that you can give to P and Q are all equivalent in terms of whether P happens to be true or not, and whether Q happens to be true or not. It doesn't matter to me what you think P stands for. Just tell me whether P happens to be true. If it doesn't matter to me what you think Q stands for, just tell me whether Q happens to be true. So these are infinitely large classes which are basically equivalent. Okay? And what we wound up doing in this case is the infinite number of propositional interpretations were seen to be equivalent to just an exponential number of truth falsity values over the proposition symbol. And if you can reason over them, you can reason over essentially the entire set of inferences. And we do the same thing for first order logic. And we realize that for the instead of proposition symbols, we talk about ground atomic sentences. Sentences of the type love, Tom, Jerry. That corresponds to a proposition. Love, Jerry, Tom. That corresponds to another proposition. Anytime you can construct a ground atomic sentence, that's a proposition. And then you can start thinking of your first order logic as really a proposition logic made up of these proposition symbols. Everything is fine and dandy, we get done. We don't get done, only the problem is that there are function symbols and we'll deal with them next time. Okay? We'll stop here and you can pick up your exam on the way out.